Okay, so we have Colossians 3, 20 and 21, which is about children and fathers. So as the introduction, I just have a couple of questions to get us thinking. What is the cultural attitude toward parenting right now? How would you describe it?
Soft.
Soft, okay. Other descriptions.
Lacking.
Okay.
Convenient.
Disinterested.
They can put a babysitter and let somebody else raise them while you go to work.
Okay.
Just not at them.
Yeah.
Distracted.
Never say no.
All kinds of.
I think the other one is, I have high wealth Korean friends, and they have factories for perfection. Like they are building future leaders and CEOs, and nothing will get in the way of that. Mm-hmm. And their life becomes the total investment in the creation of
a prodigy.
The most capable people on the planet, and they'll march over anything and anyone to get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in some ways, like it ranges from these children are an inconvenience to me, or they're the source of my hopes and dreams. Right? They're wrapped up in that little bundle of joy. Right? There's a whole. We could talk for weeks about kind of problems that we see, and today we're going to talk about some of those problems, especially at the end. But we're also. It's good for us to consider, like, how am I doing as a parent, if you are a parent? If you're a grandparent, how can I support my children as they raise their children? Or there are still things that I've been told, I don't have any adult children yet, but there are ways that parenting shifts, and I still parent and give wisdom and love my children when they're grown. So next question is, what are some of the parenting fads that have been popular in your lifetime? Some of you, that's longer than others. But as you've seen parenting trends shift and change, what are some of those trends that you've seen?
Helicopter parenting.
Yeah, it's like always there, always trying to make sure that you're ready to intervene if necessary. Helping move. I've heard that called snowplow parenting.
Mm-hmm. Like you just, make everything easy.
Right. Good. What else?
Gentle parenting.
Ooh. Yeah.
In our day, they had to remind parents at 10 o'clock that they had children. Where are your children? So, yeah. It was
yeah.
A little different. Feral. We were feral.
Kind of a let them raise themselves.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Okay.
Free range.
Free range. We can call that free range parenting.
It worked quite well.
Attachment parenting.
Attachment?
Yeah, just keep them close and dependent.
Yeah, I don't know what we want to call it, but like right now, seeing a lot of kids kind of just pacify the kid, keep them busy as I do my thing. And Heather, you kind of mentioned that a little bit ago, whether that's pacifying them with a device, a screen, or a medication. This kid is just, let's give him a pill. Those are dangerous, right, obviously. So as we think through, it's really easy to kind of look at other people and say, well, they're really messing that kid up. This is the downfall of our society, as parents like them. There will be some of that, because it's pointing those things out is kind of helpful to see the contrast before what God calls us to do as parents and what Paul is talking about here in our text today. And what there, so that's helpful contrast, but we also want to make sure that we're evaluating. There's many, many ways that I'm messing up, you know, with my kids. And so I don't want to always just be like, well, at least I'm not a gentle parent over there, or I'm not the helicopter. Well, and there are probably ways that we stray into those things a bit too much. So be kind of also self-evaluating. Why do I parent my kids? What am I doing? Where are my... if I'm going to mess up, if I'm going to err, where is that going to be? And how do I address that? So we want to make sure that we're looking at our own tendencies here too. So the text is Colossians 3, 20 and 21. And Paul says, "Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged." So again, very brief here what Paul's doing. One verse to wives, one verse to husbands, one verse to children. So let's start there. What's the command that Paul gives the kids?
Obey your parents.
Obey your parents. Very good. That's command. No option. He's not giving them an out at the moment, but he says obey the parents. How does he qualify or clarify that command?
In everything.
In everything. Man, kids. So, they are to obey in everything. Okay? Now, in the context, remember what Paul has been doing. He's been talking about, okay, even from the beginning of the book through chapter 3, hey, set your minds on things above. The way that Christ, if you are in Christ, it changes your whole life. And so now he's systematically walking through, hey, husbands, love your wives. You don't just rule like it was culturally at the time. Husbands do whatever they want. They are complete authority in their homes. No, husbands, love your wives in a sacrificial way. Wives, submit yourselves willingly, joyfully to your husband, the leadership of your husband. And so he's kind of just helping them remind you, okay, in Christ, here's how the home should look. Husbands do this, wives do this, children do this. You obey in everything. That wouldn't have been a shocker to the kids then. But the fact that he does talk to the children is kind of, it elevates their status a little bit. Because remember, in this culture, kids are nothing. Like in some of the commentaries reading about these, in the culture, in Roman culture, the dad could decide that the child didn't need to live. They could just decide to kill them. If they had any defect, any disability, they were often abandoned. Sometimes, in some cases, they were drowned. Like if they had a certain defect, they just drowned their kids. Like it was nothing. There's no dignity, no idea that these are precious, created in the image of God. There's nothing like that. So Paul, by giving them a command here, talking to the children, not just skipping over them, is a kind of a new thing. That would have been a little bit surprising to a Roman Greek audience. So, obey the children in everything. And this next part is really interesting. What motivation are they given?
It pleases the Lord.
Pleases the Lord. That is a very unique, in Ephesians, remember, obey your parents and the Lord, for this is right. This is the right thing to do. It's your duty, right? He gives that motivation, and then he also gives the motivation in verse 2 or 3, honor your father and mother, that it may go well with you and you may live long in the land. It's like, it's going to go well with you if you do this. Here, he gives them the motivation, hey, it pleases the Lord. I think that's a really powerful thing, just kind of an interjection here for our kids to hear. There's not a lot of like direct commands to children, but hey, to be able to sit your children down, to sit my girls down and say, hey, you want to please the Lord? It's pleasing to the Lord to obey your parents. So like that's a unique opportunity, and given to children, that can be a very hopeful, wonderful like thing to help inspire them to, okay, well, if I say that I want to love Jesus, this is the way that I can love him. Is by obeying my parents and everything. Some translations would say this is pleasing to the Lord, but I think that the effect is still the same. Like if the kids obey their parents and everything, it pleases the Lord. So I think we can say, hey, you want to, your life from here on out, if you're in Christ, is to live in thanksgiving and worship and desire to glorify and please the Lord. For you in this time of your life, the primary way that you do that is you obey your parents. It's a wonderful command, wonderful motivation. Now, I'm going to skip to why is verse 21 an important balancing verse to to this one. 21 would be, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. How can that be a really important balance to telling children, obey your parents in everything?
Warns the father to not be a taskmaster.
Yeah.
And just exasperate his kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're thinking through and remembering, what would the audience expect to hear? This would be a new one for the fathers. If father, your temptation, again, the same way, the temptation for a person placed in leadership with authority over another person in a marriage is for you to be demanding, to be harsh, and to expect my rules, my way, or the highway. That's what was culturally the case there. And so when Paul says to the husbands, love your wives, that would be surprising. When he says to the fathers here, don't provoke your children, that would be surprising. Who cares if the children are provoked? They're children, right? That would be the expectation. But Paul says that your union with Christ, it changes how you live, it changes how you love your wife, and it changes how you relate to your children. So let's look at that verse. What's the command of fathers?
Do not provoke your children.
Don't provoke your children. Now, is it qualified anyway? Maybe
no,
clarified.
There's no unless.
Yeah.
It doesn't say you can provoke them sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
It says don't.
Yeah. Don't provoke them unless they really deserve it. Then have at it. No, there's not a qualification like that. He does give you, like, the reason for it. Don't provoke your children. Why?
You don't want to discourage them.
They'll become discouraged. There's... And I'm going to kind of move through this a little bit quickly. The surprising thing here is that the word that Paul uses here for provoke is actually a little bit different word than he uses in Ephesians. So the Ephesians definitely has that anger. Like, so that's translated, do not provoke your children to anger. And here it says, do not provoke your children. And I thought that was interesting. I think it can still have overlapping meaning, but in this text, a lot of the commentaries were saying, in the same way that the husbands become embittered, that sense where a husband, do not be embittered towards your wife, is here as well. Do not make your children, do not cause them to be embittered. Don't cause them to be bitter by your behavior, by the words that you say, by how you relate to them. So I skipped a point here too. Paul uses the word fathers here, and a lot of the commentaries would say it can include mothers, and I think that for application purposes it does. But Paul is likely talking to fathers specifically because, for all the reasons we've talked about, the fathers were used to being the authority and to having the ultimate say-so. Their word was law. And so he's talking directly to fathers, and by extension, I think we can include mothers in that, but in the context, he's saying, fathers, make sure that you're not provoking your children. You have the temptation, the propensity to provoke your children, to make them bitter. So be very careful with that. And then the last word that I wanted to put a note in there is the discouraged word. It comes from two roots that mean without passion. So behaving and treating kids in a way where they lose a drive, they lose excitement, enthusiasm in the way that we can treat them as fathers and mothers. So be careful about that. He says, don't treat them in ways that make them disheartened, don't cause them to lose heart, to be exasperated, to be confused, that leads to just despondent, and later it will lead to resentment. So those are the kind of the key words I wanted to pull out there. And so now with the rest of our time, I wanted to kind of, at any point here, I didn't put a lot of questions, but I'm going to pause for comments and things and observations. But there are, it's a very straightforward couple of commands here. Children, obey in everything. because it pleases the Lord. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. It can lead them to be discouraged. Don't do those things. So the harder part by far here, in my opinion, and we were talking last night, Anna and I, and just thinking through how all the myriad of ways that fathers can and parents can exasperate your children. A lot of the things that we've talked about already that we see in the culture can lead to children who are exasperated, either in the moment or are going to lead to exasperation, right? So I have several sources that I've kind of pulled from ways that we can exasperate, provoke our children to be exasperated, to be. One book that I thought is very practical, a very good book, is called Purposeful and Persistent Parenting. The authors are John and Cindy Rackett. And so they really major on four ways that we have to be consistent. So consistency is very important. We all know that we need to be consistent in everything, but especially in parenting. And they kind of break it down in categories. What does consistency look like? And so the opposite would be something that would provoke our children to frustration and anger. So if we look there, consistency over time. So that means don't change your parenting philosophy with the fads. We've talked about the fads that have come and gone. If over time I tell my kids, hey, now we're going to do this. When I say X, you're going to have to do this. Now, and then I realize after 2 days, that's not working. Let me try the gentle parenting. Okay, Johnny, and then we do the gentle parenting thing for a little while. Oh, that's not working. And then now I'm going to be the taskmaster slave driver dad. And so the way that I change the approach to parenting, if I'm inconsistent with that, can really exasperate the kid. They do not know what's going on. They don't know what to expect from dad and from mom. So the risk of being inconsistent over time in my approach to my kids and my treatment of my kids and the rules that I make and don't make for my kids can really be frustrating and confusing. So some parents can be inspired by a social media post, a book, or an article, and then switch to something new in a few days. So that kind of inconsistency can cause, whiplash for the kids and really frustrate. Second one is consistency between what you say and do. Okay, the do as I say, not as I do that we kind of chuckle at and use is not good, not helpful. This is especially dangerous for Christian parents who teach their children, we honor God, we speak the truth, we love sacrificially, we work hard, while I claim more dependence than I should on my taxes, right? When I say bad words, when I get cut off in traffic, or I cut people off in traffic, or like the inconsistencies. And you might say, okay, those are little things, Brock, but if there is room for that in my life, whereas I tell my kids to do X and then they see dad doing Y, that creates in them, it's like, must not either, doesn't matter, or there's no problem with that. And so it's hard to draw lines. But on the stuff that really counts, tell the truth. No, you either tell the truth or you don't value the truth. And who values the truth? God values the truth. Right, he hates lies. And so as much as we can, be consistent between what we tell our kids and how we live our lives before them. Okay, consistency between mom and dad. Don't allow kids to parent hop until they get what they want. Right? Sometimes they learn that if they ask one parent, they have a better chance than the other. So they will learn that, and then they'll kind of circumvent that part. But if mom tells you no, do not come to ask me if you can. Or vice versa. If dad tells you no, you do not go and to mom and see if I can get a better answer. Okay? There is going to be some of that happens naturally. But as a family, especially fathers, we lead in having the discussion, hey, little Jimmy, if you ask me and I say no, and then you ask mom and she says yes, you're in trouble. Now you are dishonoring dad. You're dishonoring mom. You're not obeying your dad, your father, and everything as pleases the Lord. So don't allow that. Be on the same page. There's some in reading between the lines there that requires mom and dad to be on the same page, right? My wife and I have to have consistent, you know, ideas of what is permissible generally and what is not. So that requires communication.
But, I mean, it seems like that tends to breed a lot of disunity between a husband and wife, too, when that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like sometimes you see a lot of families that they have kids in the home and everything is done to, we want the best for the kids. And then once the kids are out of the home, the mom and dad, I mean, the husband and wife, don't, there's no relationship there. They've been so focused on catering to the kids,
mm-hmm.
and they're almost like the kids, not that the kids pit mom and dad against each
mm-hmm.
other, but that
mm-hmm.
pits mom and dad against each other. And then the kids are gone. There's no, you see a lot of breakups or divorce or hard relationship after the kids are gone.
Yeah, so having a kid-centric home is bad for a marriage and it's bad for the family.
Right.
Yeah.
I would say along with what you're saying, not pitting a parent against another is, we decided early on that we wouldn't contradict each other in front of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I don't agree with what's happening, I don't say anything until we're away.
Mm-hmm.
Because they need to see us as unified.
Right.
If they see a chink in the armor or a crack, it's like, game on.
Yep.
Yeah.
Writing that one down.
Yeah.
Now I know.
They don't agree there.
That is extremely important. And I think the important thing, like the life advice, I think the best advice that I've ever given is just, hey, play the long game. If in the moment my wife tells them that they can do something that I really would rather them not, or vice versa, tells them not to do something but I'd be okay with it, I'm going to back my wife. I'm going to say, yeah, no, don't do that. Your mom said no. Listen to your mother. Like, there's some of that that I need to. We do need to be unified, even if I don't agree in the moment. So that is very important, because in the long term, it is very important for our kids to see mom and dad are together, and they're unified in this. That's safe. That's a solid thing for me to remember, to lie on, to rest in.
I've got a question. How would you counsel someone? So, like, let's say you know you have a new believer with young children, first, second, third, fourth grade,
mm-hmm.
they've come to a knowledge of the Lord, they're trying to implement best practices. Like, what advice would you give, or how would you counsel someone who's trying to implement some of these things with an established pattern of not implementing these things? Like, what advice would you give someone who's trying to do these things without exacerbating their kids? Like, how do you change patterns in your life without exacerbating your kids? I don't know if I'm making sense.
Yeah, yeah. So you're talking about just between the parent and the child.
Yeah, like
okay.
Parent-child relationships, like, you know, someone comes to faith and they realize, well, I'm giving I'm pacifying my kid with
mm-hmm.
a screen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, like, is it exacerbating your child, or is it agitating your child to just cold turkey? You know what I'm saying? Like, to
mm-hmm.
just change patterns of life right off the cuff? Or, like, how would you counsel someone who's trying to do those things, but, like, institute them for the long run and not exacerbate them?
Right. So I think the first thing that, if I'm talking to the dad, you need to go to your child and seek forgiveness for the way that you have mishandled and not parented them correctly, as consistent with Scripture. So you go to your child, hey, son, I love you. I have not parented you well. I have allowed you to get away with X, or I've let you do too much screen time. And what I'm seeing in the Scriptures is that I'm not doing my job. So please forgive me. And here are the changes that we're going to make. And it's because I love you, and because I am called to make these decisions that lead to you having an opportunity to know the Lord and to develop and grow into a responsible, mature young person. So, like, yeah, there's seek forgiveness, and you can kind of work with a spouse if one's available, to, as far as like cold turkey or not. I would lean a hard abrupt turn, but I mean that'd be something to work out. I would say maybe we go from whenever you're making me upset to, like, you get 30 minutes of that game, whatever it is. There's enough. I tend to be, and you too probably, it's seen in education, we see kind of the effects of this like when it's just give your child whatever, and they're the I'm seeing students now who just having a conversation and like it's like blank. And I don't know 100% for sure how much they're on screens, but I can guess. If I was a betting man, I'd put money that they're spending a lot of time on screens. And so like I feel like I'm seeing a bigger and bigger effect. I'm like, hey, why did you do that? And then there's like, are you? And I think part of that is that at younger and younger ages, we're seeing more and more time on screen. So with that, I think the wisdom would be, hey, we need to cut that stuff out. Go outside, okay? Eat some dirt, like whatever it is. Just go and go play with them. Like that's the other part of it too, as a father, that is my responsibility too, is to be engaged and to do that as well. But yeah, that's a great question. And there's, with all of these things, I think the pattern that you'll see here through as we go through these, you can fall off on one extreme or the other. You can fall off the horse on both sides, as I like to say, right? So you can be too lenient and you can be too restrictive. It's trying to have wisdom, asking godly people around you who have done it, like what should I do? What do you think here about how we're doing screen time, how we're doing bedtime, how we're doing meals, how we're doing discipline, how we're doing Bible time and family worship? Like asking questions, because hey, that's what we're here. We need each other, right? And so the more important the task that we're called to do, parenting ranks pretty high, right? The more it's important for me to be wise, to be biblical about this. And if I have questions, I should be asking some godly men and women around me. I will tell you that some of the most impactful and things that have formed the way I have parented, yes, there's books, but I remember as a college student going to the Marshall's house and kind of watching them, how they did things. And I would ask them questions. And Scott would take, he's like, well, come here, Addie, come here. And we kind of talk through. And he's like, now, let's talk through what we do when there's discipline needed. And so I got to see it and see how it was done. Not literally done, he didn't discipline her there, but he just talked through the process they go through. That was really helpful for me. Like, that is not what I thought discipline was going to be like for my children, right? And so talking to the Marshalls, we've talked to the Hinses, we've talked to a lot of people, we've observed, hey, those kids are well-behaved. How do they do that? You know, some observations are really helpful. And then, of course, the Scott recommended that I read Shepherding a Child's Heart, one of the best books I've read on parenting, because it just completely changed how I thought about discipline. Okay, so those are really important things. Ask godly people around you. Be humble enough to admit that I might be doing this wrong. Maybe there's a better way to do that. Carol.
Back to the screen time, my daughter was given, I call it a great compliment. Her daughter was, they're in public school, and as she entered middle school, the first conference, the teacher said, I can tell you by looking at my class and watching which kids have been on screens and which ones have not. You can pick mm-hmm. them out very quickly, and she said, it's obvious. The attention span that your daughter gives me is huge. Mm-hmm. And of course, luckily, or God bless America here, that Kara learned this early, that you don't put kids on screen. Some kids learn it a little too late, mm-hmm. but this girl's never hardly on it, and there's a huge mm-hmm. difference.
Yeah.
I know I'm stating the obvious, but I just think an example of teacher complimenting the mm-hmm. parent
yeah.
is nice.
Yeah, and the way that God has created our brains, mm-hmm. their neuroplasticity is a thing where, like, you can recover a lot of good brain function even after, you know, a long time, too much time on a screen. So it's not... we want to be able to be hopeful to kids too. Okay, well, Johnny's been on a screen since he was two, so he's gonna be what he is. No, not necessarily. Like, set a book in front of him, get him outside, play games. A lot of, went to a training too, and this is again too much probably in education. But thinking through, they're having to come up with seminars. But like, how do you like help kids, because we can't change them at their home. We can't change what the rules are. And do you know what their studies and their research have found is the best thing to counteract that? Human connection. Mm-hmm. Like, conversations with people, like interacting, playing games. Like that's how you do it. So parents, we can all do that. Even if we've messed it up before. Okay, we're gonna sit and stare at each other. Like, that can't be worse than the screen. Like, so even if you sit, you don't know what to do, you're just twiddling your thumbs. Like, that's good. So, I don't know how we got on that. Wait, anyway, back here.
I had a comment about contradicting, or the one parent, the other parent. I think something that's also worth mentioning is letting the kids hear the conversation. Asking for permission to go do something and letting parents hear mom and dad have the conversation. And I agree with Heather, once the line has been drawn, the line has been drawn. And if we don't agree, we can talk about that privately after the kids have gone. But I think it's healthy for kids to hear mom and dad have conversation about, well, I see the benefit here. Well, you know, I really don't like da da da. And something that we have established is once dad says what he says, that's the answer. And in a similar way, if I don't agree, we can have a conversation later. I think it's also okay to, hey, we've thought about this some more. Here's something that we're gonna change on what we have established.
Yeah.
I think letting kids know that the conversation's gonna be had. We have your best interest in mind. Whatever we say is law. There's some wiggle room if we make the wrong call. But for the most part, once we have said what we have said, that is the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I think that can be helpful, especially as your kids get older and they need to see a picture of how does a dad lead,
right,
make those decisions? How does a mom voice her opinion and still be submissive and go along with that? Our girls are gonna need to see that, right? Our boys are gonna need to see, how do you lead a family? Does it mean I just know that's what I said and that's how it's gonna, like, that's valuable, and that could be a good way to do that, is have those conversations with the kids. And, hey guys, come here. You can even say, hey, we're gonna do this together, because mom and dad need to talk about this. Yeah.
Well, and these conversations can happen around the dinner table too. Mm-hmm. This is something I want to do. Well, I don't know. And it kind of does tie into the screen thing. If the kids are constantly away or being pacified, and you're not engaging in conversations with your kids naturally, they're not going to be able to see it modeled.
Mm-hmm. Good. Any other? Chris?
I think something with this that I'll admit that I'm terrible for, and I think this is a interact with wife and not interview your kids thing, is that especially in homes like many of ours, where we have single-income families, which necessitate extra long hours for the man that works out of the home, is I am very prone to come in and essentially para-jump into a battle that's going on, whether it's a real battle or a perceived battle, because it's been a long day. And then I start making decisions based on that. And I was not debriefed by the field general before I start making decisions.
And you undo things that mom's been working on.
Or I just make bad decisions because I'm not coming in with good information. And so I think that's something that we need to remember too, that I think for us, like for most of us in here, the problem isn't gentle parenting. The problem isn't that we're not the parents. Oh my goodness, I see this at Walmart all the time. We're not the parents that have the kid with like a 17-inch iPad Pro like attached to their face in like the chair in the cart at Walmart. We're not those parents. However, we have homes where I think that we are probably prone to embittering because we have highly patriarchal family roles, and that we have husbands who lead in a way that I think is in accordance with what Scripture commands. However, I think with that, sometimes we can come in and use that as a cudgel, and that's probably the point where most of us are more likely to lean, is that. And so I think that we have to remember that we do have a partner at home, and that partner, frankly, knows far more and far better about what's going on in our homes on a daily basis than we do.
Yeah.
And so don't go in.
So yeah. So whether that's I'm tired, I want to just get this done, stop it. That kind of desire to immediately cause it to be peaceful, because I need peace. Or we can be I think the temptation, and we see it a lot, we see it everywhere, but like the temptation to treat everything as if it's really urgent, and almost nothing is urgent. Like almost nothing is a true crisis. So if I go into that, I just need to fix this right now. I'm treating it like it's a crisis. Sometimes there might be a need for that. Most of the time, the vast majority of the time, I need to be quiet and listen for a moment and see whether it's talking to my wife or talking to my daughter and see, okay, what's bothering you? Knowing that what comes, that might be a long conversation. Right? And so another thing we just talked about last night is like, okay, I've got to listen. Okay, focus. Like, it's just, we ask a question, and depending on the age and the topic, that's maybe not interesting to me, like down there on the interest scale, like I need to engage, and I need to listen, and not just like, come on, sweetheart, come on, get to the point. Like, I can't do that. That's not showing that I love and value my daughter. So being patient and having the discipline to listen before I just make a decision, make a judgment on what discipline, who needs to do, whose turn is it, all those kinds of things. So there are, don't treat everything like a crisis. And I have to remind myself that as well, because sometimes, yeah, we just want to get it done. Like this is, and what we end up doing is we shortchange or we short circuit an opportunity that God is giving us to teach our kids something or to sanctify us in some way. And I take a short and throw things. So, so moving right along. A last thing, consistency between public and private. Do we act differently when I have a guest at my house? Do I talk to my kids differently? I say extra long prayers to bless the food, or I bless the food, period. Like, is there a difference between how we do things in the normal life and when we have people into our home? When our family goes to Walmart, or we're at a restaurant, or we're at the park, do we behave differently? Are there different sets of rules in how we treat people and treat our parents and children and all those things? Is there consistency? There should be consistency no matter where we are. Now, we obviously have different rules, like at my house, than there is at the park, right? They can do some different things. So there's some wisdom and calls that we can make that are different. But the way that I talk to my kids, the way that I treat my wife, the way that I discipline them when they're in trouble, shouldn't be worlds different if somebody's at my house or whether we're all just our family. If there is, that teaches our kids, you just gotta live a double life. Like, this is okay to do at home. This is okay to do at home when there's people here. That's hypocrisy. It's making room for that. So,
Brock, on the other side of things too, sometimes folks are fearful of disciplining children in public places,
mm-hmm.
And so I think it goes on that side of things too. Like, children can sniff inconsistency whenever we're afraid of doing certain things in public places or whatnot too. So I think that partially we do need to have the same life at home as we do in public spaces. But I think most, like in a lot of senses, like the fear of man and the fear of civil repercussions,
mm-hmm.
for disciplining,
yeah.
children in public places, it keeps us from doing our job effectively as
right.
well as parents. And I feel like we shouldn't be as fearful to do that in those places.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that you have to, discipline your children in the bathroom at Panda Express or whatever. But I will say though, like, sometimes that thought crosses my mind where I'm like, what if someone hears my child screaming from the bathroom? And I get CPS called on me or whatever. And in reality, that's my, my fear causing inconsistency in public places as well.
Yeah. Well, I think, a couple things. One thing that helps that is like the consistency on the front end of every time my child at home does this thing or does not obey, there's a consequence, that there's almost a carryover effect that it can happen. The other thing is one, I think it's that book I mentioned, they just recommend, hey, if that happens and you're out in public, go home, do it. And it'll only take once or twice before they realize, oh, well, maybe dad won't do it right here, but he'll take me home. And then now we lost out on the eating out, or we lost out on the park or the party or whatever that is. So like the expectation is that you, no matter where we are, you obey mommy and daddy. And if I'm consistent in that, there's probably won't have to do that very often. But yeah, I think those are good. You can go to the car, or we can just, hey, you know, sweetheart, now we're going home. And that's not going to, you know, ruin their life. It's going to be a valuable lesson, potentially. Alex, did you have something?
I guess, like, when we had younger kids, like, you know, like, my mom gave me advice, and I don't know if it's kind of a cultural deal, but, like, if a kid throws a fit, like, say, in church or something, don't take them out, because it's like, they're going to figure out, well, I'm in a place I don't really want to be, so we're going to leave. You know, I don't know. It's kind of, so you kind of have that in the back of your mind, like, okay, what is this, right?
Well,
I mean, I understand restaurant or someplace fun. You know,
well,
but
I think in church even, and I will couch this with this. Maybe this is a little bit of my opinion. Maybe a lot. I don't know. We do not allow our kids to throw fits.
Yeah.
Like when our girls, as they're young, flop down on the ground, like we don't say, oh, she's terrible twos. It's just let her figure it out. And she's got nope. It's you need to show self-control. And if you don't, first of all, the flopping on the ground, that's a disciplinable offense. So we go to the back room, we talk about it, we give spankings, and then we say, okay, no, we're not going to do that. A common phrase that I don't know where we got it from, but it's like, you can cry softly if you need to. Like, if people hear me say that, they're probably going to be like, oh, how dare you? You know, but like, you can show self-control. The other thing my girls will tell you, is something really sad? Does it hurt really bad? The answer is no to that, then you need to stop crying. Maybe, okay, sorry. But that's the conversations that we have, because we, and same thing for me, in the same way that I need to show self-control, they need to show self-control. The kids who just are allowed to vent whatever they're feeling, what kind of kid does that turn into?
Yeah.
Super impulsive, just super selfish. Like whatever they do, whatever they want is what they will act out, and is not good, is not pleasant, is not a blessing to people.
We kept a wooden paddle in the car, and the kids knew it. The problem is, we didn't have cameras back then. People now, if I take a child to the car and decide to give them a swat, somebody's going to be filming me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think cameras have kind of maybe changed some of this.
Maybe.
Ask the criminal defense lawyer in the room. I don't care. Corporal punishment is explicitly and clearly legal by statute
yes.
in Kansas.
Okay,
and
good.
DCF
it is.
And secondly, as a practical matter,
thank you.
Like, DCF can't get their heads out of their rears long enough to do an investigation on kids that are being tortured in private schools, being abused in the foster care system. Do you think they're going to investigate us? Come on.
Yeah. Well, and I think those are kind of on the extreme sides too, but there is a way, and we'll get there as well. I can provoke my child with my discipline. Like there, so we don't want to go too far either way. Like we don't want to say, well, just spank them, you know, every time. There are often times when we do need to spank the children. We use the rod as the scriptures command us to do, right? We want to do that wisely, and we don't want to go overboard. Right? There are ways that we can do it too often or too hard or too extreme, and we will cause just as much damage to a child than if we never did it at all and we just let them do whatever they want. There's different kinds of damage, but the way that if I am overbearing and bordering on abusive or just flat out abusive, that's not a, well, if you're going to err on that, like, that's not good. There's I don't know if I should say irreparable damage, but like if I abuse my child physically or even emotionally, like if I just verbally tear them apart, like that's extremely damaging. You talk about what is going to lead to the discouraged child. Those are two of the things that are going to rank right up there at the high end of what will provoke my child to the point where they've lost heart? My dad criticizing me for how I played in the ball game, or how I, you know, or why couldn't you be more like, all the things. Like, me being critical or cussing at them and just flying off the handle. And I know these are both extremes. Like, those are damaging, and we will provoke them and cause them to lose heart in those ways as well.
I think, like, if you go back to the self-control thing, right? Mm. To tell your you need to have self-control, it feels a little like you're overreacting sometimes. Like, this is a big deal to my 4-year-old, and mm-hmm. I'm just telling her to, you know, ignore her emotions, and then you can just go down that whole spiral. Mm-hmm. But one thing I've really considered is that, like, I'm not just raising a child. I'm preparing somebody for adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot have my 4-year-old who has no self-control with her emotions right now, because what that will spiral into is a 16-year-old who has mm-hmm. no self-control over her emotions, or a 25-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in some young adults now who've never been taught self-control in their emotions. And it's really disheartening mm-hmm. to see that in them, but it's very encouraging to me as a parent to be like, okay, I need to have my 5-year-old now, my mm-hmm. 5-year-old girl, be able to show self-control mm-hmm. now in her emotions and not fly off the handle and not cry about everything and not do all these things. Even though as a mom, it feels very, can sometimes feel very harsh, because it's like, okay, well, she's genuinely sad about this thing, but yeah, we don't have to cry about everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the way that I even do that with my daughters is important. I need to do that in a self-controlled way.
Yeah.
Stop it, show self-control. And you just yell at him. You know, or like, what's wrong with you? No, it's like, sweetheart. Show self-control. Yeah. I can model it too. I can model self-control as I tell them to be self-controlled. You're doing these things that are I'm worried about how this make me look, so I'm gonna show self-control, hey, sweetheart. Like, this is not something that warrants this kind of a response. Quiet, you're crying. Does something hurt? And we're asking the conversation. We're having that very calm, direct conversation where I'm describing for her why she needs to show self-control and how she can do that. Okay? Stand up. Off of the ground. You can sit here. All those kinds of things as we coach and discipline. That's the training of our children in those things. Any final comments on that one?
I think too. We want to screen time's easy, both of you right now. However, the self-control thing helped. I've represented people in their 80s that have spent their whole life in federal prisons. I have a 25-year-old who got found guilty of murder last year. She's in prison for the rest of her natural life. I represent people in criminal cases, and frankly, a lot of other stuff, where the reason why they're dealing with me is a fundamental inability to have any self-control over their life,
mm-hmm.
and then a lack of ability to take any responsibility for that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so putting this work in now,
mm-hmm.
at the front end, helps create a person. When we talk about, like, we're making tiny, we have tiny people that will become full-size people eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully these actions, you know, worst case scenario, our kids aren't believers. But hopefully the actions that we took in parenting them in a prudent manner helps create an adult that is at least functional
mm-hmm.
and can operate within society.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people that, like, you know, if you go and look at the jail roster for the Lyon County Jail, it's like 70 people that are in and out of the Lyon County Jail constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been in and out of the Lyon County Jail since I've been practicing law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they don't have the ability to do this. And it was because their parents did not parent them,
mm-hmm.
or they had no parents, or whatever the circumstance
yeah.
was. But they just had none of that.
Yeah. Yep. Consistency, engaged. Yeah, those are all really important things. We're going to try and go through these next few pretty quickly. Some of them are pretty self-explanatory. Unreasonable expectations, right? We do need to have expectations for our children, right? We should communicate those, communicate the rules, but if we aren't careful, we can expect too much or too little. So this is one of those fall off the horse both ways. So unreasonable expectations based on age. Does your child understand what you expect of them? If you think through what frustrates you, what I'm guessing a high thing on that list is being expected to do something that you don't understand. If you ask me to fix your car, I'm sorry, I don't know, and then you're mad at me because I didn't do it. Well, so I'm sorry, that's not going to work for you. I don't know how to fix cars. I don't know much about them at all. If you ask me to do something, I don't understand it, I'm not going to be successful at it. And then if you show frustration at it, then it's worse. It's compounding, right? So do you understand, does your child understand what you expect them to do and how you expect them to do it and how in the time frame that you're expecting it? Like, over coach them sometimes at the front end to make sure that they really know, and then we can see if it's, are you being disobedient or you just don't know what you're supposed to do? So those are questions to ask. Are you expecting too little of them? That's the other way. So, well, I know Johnny's 12, but I still tie his shoes and I have to cut a steak for him and I have to do all the things. Like, okay, those, like, what are you expecting from your son? Like, nothing. So, like, those kinds of things. Evaluate your expectations. Are you unreasonably expecting nothing? And going to lead to some of the behaviors that Chris is talking about. All right, unreasonable expectations of achievement. Being overly critical or over accepting of a child's academic, athletic, character development, skill, talent development, all of those kinds of things. If I criticize my children after the sports game because they should have played better, and now there is a way to do that to where you, if my child's not trying, that's a thing we can address. If they miss the game-winning shot and I'm really angry about it because now they make me look like I wasn't a clutch player in high school, that's a problem, right? That is all wrong. That's an unreasonable expectation. I'm getting angry at my child for something silly like that, something sinful like that. Like, that is wrong. You missed 17 notes in your little piano recital. What is all those hours of practice? We just wasted them. Like, there's all of those kinds of things that we can unreasonably expect our children to be perfect or achieve better. Or, you know, okay, my child didn't turn any of his homework in. It's like, well, not everybody's an A student. Okay, is that because he's not an A student or because I didn't make him do his homework? Right? And I'm allowing him or her to be lazy and not exert himself or herself. Like, those are problems with my expectations of my children. I do need, and sports are wonderful and they can be valuable vehicles for them to learn how to work hard at something. So is school. Reading. The kid doesn't like to read. I'm sorry, I know, but it's important and you gotta work hard at it. And I'm gonna expect you to work hard at it. We're gonna spend this much time in it because that's important. This treating, you, being, saying please and thank you. Well, she's only 3. Well, yep, she can still say please and thank you. Like, those are, I'm gonna have that expectation because if I don't do it then, is she just gonna magically start doing it when she's 6 or 7? No, I've got, again, building full of kids who don't say it, right? Like, there's things that happen. Classrooms full of, like, some of you who work in the education or have a lot of interactions with kids, where there's camps and things like that, you see kids who they've been trained to say it or they have not. Okay, many expectations. I was good at blank, so he should be as well. Or that kind of an expectation. Vicarious living through the children. This is the sports. I see it a lot at sports. That's kind of stereotypical. But try to, like, my kid's going pro. And so I'm going to push and push and have these expectations that I'm going to have private lessons and we're on traveling teams and we're spending tens of thousands of dollars a year going to tournaments and lessons and all that. My goodness. Okay, so that is, you can see where I'm leaning on that, sorry. That is something that I'm expecting them, if I would just save that money, I could pay for their college. They don't need a scholarship. Okay, but, soapbox, sorry. But that, me living my sports dreams out through my children is not good. That's an unreasonable expectation. Moving right along here. Comparisons. There's another easy one. Why don't you be like your brother, your sister? Why don't you be like, you know, Jane at church, who sits quietly in church and doesn't, you know, all those things, like comparing those things. One of the commentaries I was reading talked about, don't compare them with a different version of them. Like, you're 5, I'm not going to compare you to what you should be when you're 12, or what you used to be like when you were cute. Like you used to do that in such a cute way, you used to say, thank you, and now you don't. What's wrong with you? Or I just train them. It's an opportunity to train. Okay, love and discipline. Comparisons, control over protection. Do your children have opportunities to kind of explore? Okay, do they have chances to make mistakes and fail at things? Do they skin their knees every now and then? Are there opportunities for that? There's overprotecting is damaging. So underprotecting also, right? So lack of love. If love sacrifices and overlooks inconveniences and idiosyncrasies that we've talked about before in other studies, personality differences, I'm going to bear with my children, bear with other people, loving forbearance, as I think it's Ephesians 4 we talked about. And I don't do that with my children. Little things that they do annoy me and I have to make a comment about it and get on to them about it. Like if there's no love and I'm not sacrificing some of my desires to love them, to spend time with them, like all of those things, am I loving them? Lack of love can provoke a child to frustration and anger. Okay? The way we talk about them, right? And this one, if the way that I joke about my children embarrasses them, I'm likely sinning against them. Now, could be that they're just really oversensitive. So, like, there's room for that. But, and we talk about this. I think it's really obvious when you hear people talk about their spouse. And if the wife or the husband talks about, you know, the ball and chain or the old, you know, and they talk about that things, what does that suggest about that relationship? If your husband heard in public, or if your wife heard the way you talk about her in public, if your child could sit there and hear what you say about them to other people and your friends, would they feel valued, loved? Are they the butt of all your jokes? The way that I talk about my children needs to be in a way that honors them and loves them. Yeah, so those things can provoke them to anger. And then lastly, seek forgiveness, acknowledge our shortcomings. If I never tell my girls that, please forgive me, I responded harshly to you. And I just, well, she's going to get over it, I'm her father, she's better respect. That's a problem. That's not humble, that's pride. That's not me being gentle. So these things, I'll leave the rest for just kind of thought questions. If unaddressed, these various ways that we can mess this up, how does it affect their relationship with you as the parent? How does it affect their relationship with their siblings and other people? How does it affect their understanding of God? How does it affect their understanding of the gospel? We can have a lot of messed up things that we're showing them about those relationships and those things. So we can grow. We need to ask God. We need to be praying for wisdom to grow in these ways to help. I think it's good to pray, Lord, please protect my girls from when I mess up. Like that doesn't mean I don't have to go to them and ask forgiveness, but like, I want to make sure I'm praying for my girls that He's going to help them deal with when their father messes things up. And helps them to see that for what it is, whether that's sin or weakness or ignorance or foolishness, they can see it, Lord willing, and they would learn from that even. So, thank you, everybody. I know there's a lot there we could probably talk about for another couple weeks, but we'll wrap it up. Thank you.